Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. In this bonus episode, I speak to Amy Dunn.
My memory is I talked to a solicitor on the phone, and boom, that's it. We're in a high court.
Yeah.
Whatever happened in between, I was too young to comprehend.
And it happened really quickly.
Oh, very quickly. Very quickly. Like, and as well, I would love to thank the solicitor that took me so seriously back then and understood the situation more than I understood the situation.
Yeah.
As well, to understand that is not okay, that is not right. He must have done his research and actually checked into what the condition was of the child, because he moved quick and we were in the high court in a blink of an eye.
In 2007, a 16-year-old Amy Dunn was pregnant with a baby girl who had a fatal fetal abnormality. At the time, Amy was in the care of the HSE, so she told a social worker about her plan to travel for a termination after finding out the devastating news. And although she was supported by her family and by the baby's father, she was told by the HSE that it wouldn't be possible for her to travel, which then led to her situation being a case in the High Court. As you'd imagine, it is an intense listen at times, so please do check the show notes in advance. In this conversation, we speak about her childhood changing from idyllic to chaotic, the ups and downs of her relationship with her mother, and ultimately the unbreakable bond they share today, and how her strength and bravery ignited a social revolution to repeal the Eighth Amendment of the Irish Constitution. We heard about her at the time as Miss D, but today we hear from the woman herself. Here it is. First up, congratulations on your book, I'm Amy Dunn. You wrote it with Orla O'Donnell, who is, of course, the legal affairs correspondent for RTÉ. Can you tell us about that experience and, I suppose, your bond with Orla?
I have to say, not that I knew what it entailed writing a book, but I am so grateful through the whole process that I had, particularly Orla on hand writing it with me. It wasn't that it was a case of where I would speak and she would write. There was times that were very emotional, nearly every conversation we had. And, you know, over the whole year, she would counsel me and look after me and mind me. And just she would always check in with me to make sure I was feeling okay. And we just really grew very close, and I nearly started feeling like she was my big sister through the whole process.
Yeah.
And that was a very special bond to have, as I don't really have many bonds with people. It became particularly close, and I depended on her then a lot more, but she was so willing to be there for me and help me mentally through the whole process.
Well, fantastic. When did you meet her first?
I met Orla first in my memory doing the Fine documentary, but I wasn't
for TG Cahill, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that she had been the news correspondent at the time of my case in 2007.
Yeah.
But even from meeting her doing the Fine documentary, from there on in, she was always watching out for me and looking out for me, and she knew where I wanted to go in life even then. So being a busy woman with her job and her own family, she still had so much time for me and helped me, guide me in the paths with the choices I was making at the time before COVID blocked everything. But she had gotten me into a few projects as well. She's awesome.
Yeah. So in terms of the book, I would love our listeners to get a sense of you. So can we start with your childhood, what it was like?
My memory of my childhood is pretty amazing. It's colourful. All you see is rainbows when I think in my head. When I was young, my memories are doing arts and crafts with my mom on the daily, you know, going for walks in the fields, going to amazing buildings and places in Galway for her. She worked with Mocness. She worked with children. She built floats for parades. So we were surrounded by the arts and crafts lifestyle and the people that came along with that, and which meant that everyone was just nice. I got to see so many different things as a child that not a normal child would get to see, so for that I am grateful. A lot of my memories as well is in Jobstown, lying down beside the fire with my mom watching the soaps and falling asleep. Everything was just natural, happy and calm. I don't ever remember a bad moment where we ever had an argument or I ever misbehaved. I was stuck to her hip, so much so that even under the age of 6, I was mitching school to run home to try and be with her, and the lollipop ladies would get stuck with me.
Oh, so yeah, it was just really natural and normal and really good.
Yeah, we had an unbreakable bond. I mean, literally every day we did plastering on balloons, and you know, there was ribbons and glitter everywhere.
She was very creative.
She was so creative. I was so creative. She painted the bath, she painted the presses. Everything had a feature in the house. You couldn't take the paintbrushes off of her, but it was gorgeous and beautiful place to grow up with my mom.
I suppose for people to get a sense of your life and what happened, you being 12 years of age, and this was when you packed your bag and you left for Drogheda, but it happened in a hurry.
Yeah, I didn't even get to pack a bag. I had nothing. So my beautiful bedroom in Salins, nothing was taken from it. I was out playing with my friends. Mm. All I remember is my mom pulling up in the evening time, quite frantic, with my little sister as a toddler in the car with my uncle, which I rarely saw, absolutely loved. He's my favourite uncle. But he was like, come on, Amy, get in the car, we're going. My mom had a way of making everything seem like an adventure. So it was like we were going on this quick holiday, just us girls, you know. So it was only when it got dark and we got to this place, which I didn't even know how to pronounce, Drogheda. I was like, Drogheda. We got there and I remember seeing these big stable doors, and it's a big red brick building. But I loved horse riding back then, so it resembled that area. So to me, it kind of looked nice. I was like, oh, where are we going? And when I got inside, I knew my mom was really upset on the way down, but she kept reassuring me everything was okay. I didn't quite know at that stage that things weren't okay. It took a moment, because when I was brought into this lovely place, which was a women's refuge, they were so good in there, and I was brought to a playroom and distracted with toys straight away. Yeah, I was 12, but I was baby-hearted as well inside, and I had my little sister. So it was only as time went on and we stayed in this refuge that I realised we weren't going home. I wasn't going back to my friends. I wasn't going back to school. I had nothing, literally, but the clothes that were on my back. It was such a strange time. I mean, it was 6 months in a women's refuge, day by day, waiting to see when we were going back home.
Why did you leave in such a hurry?
My mom and my stepdad, they had a big argument. Obviously, things got really bad at home. And that's a personal situation between the two of them. Thank God I wasn't there to physically see what happened. But my mom had obviously had enough at this stage and decided that she needed to go to a safe place with her and her children. And looking back, she made the right decision. But it's very sad at the same time. We had to build from scratch again, build our clothes up again. I remember even being brought into a room with loads of shelves and secondhand clothes in it. And even though I'd had a good life and had nice things, I was still excited to get these secondhand clothes. I felt like I was going shopping again. And them little moments stick out for me. And the moments when, you know, you had to share a sitting room with so many different random families. I had to see a lot when I was staying there. A lot of the women who came in like they weren't okay. And they were coming from crazy different kinds of backgrounds that I had never had to see growing up. And this is where I feel like the real darkness came over my life, where I realized my mom was not okay all the time. This beautiful ray of sunshine that made everything okay, she wasn't coping. My little sister was crying. She would be crying and then I'd be crying. We had a bunk bed in a small room we all shared together, and we'd take turns of who would get a cuddle each night, and the other, we'd all be crying separately to each other. We got some counselling there, but I was only young. I didn't really understand what was going on.
So a really confusing time in your life to go from that, the safety of your home environment and your friends and everything that was normal to you, because you'd only had a 2-year period anyway living in Sallins. So you were only probably starting to settle there.
It literally went from, yeah, so I was a Dublin girl moving to Kildare. Yeah. And back then, you know, like I remember my stepdad in a funny way. He made me wear my Dublin jersey to school on the first day. And there's even photos of me having a tantrum. I would not go in, you know. So I didn't really get the best start in the school anyways. And I was only after settling in. And we lived by a beautiful canal. And I love Rosie and Jim growing up. And we lived beside all them Rosie and Jim boats. It was like another little fairy tale to begin as well, you know, even though I didn't have my mom to myself. For me, it felt like a very happy environment in general, because I just had my mom there. To go to a place where I knew nobody, my mom knew nobody, we had nothing, we were homeless. I knew then at this stage we were homeless. I was 12. I was a preteen as well, and I found it very uncomfortable because there was boys staying here too, children, and I was at that conscious age, I was developing, and I found it disgusting even having to share a shower with so many different people. Some, you know, that weren't so clean, and everything just bothered me. I would not want to shower myself or put my feet on the floors, and it wasn't my home, you know. It wasn't meant to be for that long. For me, people would usually stay in a refuge for a few days or a week or so. 6 months is a big chunk of your life to spend in a refuge, you know, and sneaking in and out the doors. That's what began to happen. The more I knew I was staying in a refuge, and we would go out into the town and come back, like, you wouldn't want anyone to see you going in these doors, you know.
During this time, how was your mother's behaviour?
It was starting to decline. Like, I have not really much memories of my mom being great or okay. And even I suppose I spent a lot more time with the staff of the refuge. Maybe she was off getting counselling, trying to sort finances, sort somewhere for us to live. I would spend a lot of time in the creche. Now, for me, in my head, I know they reminded me, but I felt like I was doing work experience because I was probably the oldest kid in there at most times, and I would help out with the children. So I felt like I was of value somewhere and I was needed, and the women were lovely, thank God. But the memories only I have in there is trying to share a kitchen with loads of other families, fighting over who gets to use the TV and, you know, the tiny bedroom. I don't have a lot of, I have no memories of us being together in the refuge. It was just hectic.
Yeah. During this time, your mum was suffering with depression. So she was on...
She was on a slippery slope. She was... Okay. She was going downhill a bit fast, and she never drank. She was never a drinker, so I would have never saw my mom drink. And I don't believe that happened when she was there either. But I had learned that drink wasn't a nice thing. There was one or two times where I did see the women my mom had bonded with sneak in their little bottles of vodka. Not saying there's anything wrong with that, but it wasn't allowed, and I didn't feel comfortable with the situation. And I would, you know, I was 12, so I watched out for my mom, what she was doing, making sure she wasn't drinking. And that's kind of, I think, where the argument started to begin. I was a hormonal teenager, and I was very frustrated and confused with what the hell was going on in our life right now. It was only when we moved into our new house that things got really, really bad.
What happened?
My mom had her own property in Dublin, which she had sold. So in a sense, we were financially stable. We moved into this big, old, scary house that was used for the workers of a factory. It was on factory grounds. It was basically a derelict house. There was like 6 or 8 houses along the road, huge, huge houses, sculleries and, you know, side houses for the cleaners back in the day. My mom made an art room in there. As I said, she had gotten some money. She'd done what she could to the house to make it nice. And what happened, I am my memory is, like, say every month we'd go to the shops, and me, my little sister, my mom, and she'd buy a bottle of champagne and buy us loads of treats. And I remember the treats, like our magazines and our ice creams, and we loved Silver Mints and Milky Way. So we got all them little treats, and we'd come home and mom would have her bottle of champagne. But then that turned into, say, every 2 weeks. Then it was every week. And in the blink of an eye, it was a daily occurrence. And then even a morning occurrence in the house. So while we were staying in a town where we knew nobody, we weren't in an estate either where there was anybody else to lean on or distract myself with. There was just a field outside. At this stage, my little sister was getting more time with her father, and I was kind of the lingering teenager at home, annoying my mother. Well, my mother, you know, took to the bottle a little bit more, and understandably so. I can see why she did that. But back then, for me as a teenager, it was very scary, and it was a very hard time for me. There'd be times I really worried about if she was going to wake up, you know. I didn't realise as well it was the mix of Xanax, Lexapro and alcohol, but she wasn't aware about them medications and mixing it with alcohol. And obviously, having not been a drinker, she wasn't really able for alcohol. She would have one glass and she would slur, you know. So things got really, really, really bad.
How bad?
You know, there was times when I remember going to school and she'd forget to collect me, and I didn't even know where I lived. There was moments where she would say she was leaving with Claire and running away. When it was me, she was always going to run away with. And we would have serious arguments where I'd have to take the keys because she was severely intoxicated. There was times where she'd go out and she wouldn't come home. And there was a lot more things that, to protect her, I don't want to say, because I don't hold a grudge on her or hurt on her. But it did happen. You know, a lot happened. Things got actually more worse when I moved to the nice estate afterwards, when I was in school. That's when it got really hard and tough, when I was really trying to keep up appearances, because I'd had a hard time and I'd had no clothes and things like that. When we eventually got ourselves sorted, we moved up to a normal estate, which we thought was going to be another fresh start again. We had neighbours. There was kids from my school living in the estate. I was hanging around them. I was embarrassed and I was ashamed. I was ashamed that we didn't own the house. We rented it. I didn't understand things like that when I was younger. I just seen people owned their houses, and I knew a man gave us this house we were paying money for. And then my friends all had a mom and a dad around where I lived. And I just felt really singled out. We were from Dublin. We knew nobody. And my mom at this time was a real alcoholic, who obviously took solace in meeting people in town. She made the wrong friends, and you know, an alcoholic finds another alcoholic and they become great alcoholics together. And you know, there'd be times I come home and I didn't know the people in my house. They would take advantage of my mom. Like my mom, I get a lot from her as well. Like, she sees the best in everybody. I became friends with some bad guys from other areas. When I say bad guys, I didn't see them as bad guys. They were teenagers and they were giving me a lot of attention, and eventually I'd go out and say hello to them. I was a new girl on the block. And back then as well, the way I dressed, I didn't realise I wasn't dressing to be sexy. I was a little girl. I still played with my Barbies. I actually fought my little sister when she'd take my Barbies, and I was 12. So I still had this innocence of brain. But it really quickly changed. These guys, I mean, before I knew it, I was getting in robbed cars. I was, you know, my mom locked me in. I climbed out the bedroom window. She couldn't stop me anymore because I'd lost respect for her. And she'd lost the fight to keep me in anymore. She couldn't hold me down. She was suffering with her drinking. So while she was drinking, I took to the streets, and things got really nasty. I ended up in different foster homes, four altogether. My little sister spent a lot of time with her dad. I remember really where it all kicked off was my mom went to do the shopping one day and she just didn't come home. And I didn't let anyone know for a long time, but there was nothing in the presses. Like, when we didn't have food, we didn't have nothing. Yeah. Not even seasoning. And she went to do the shopping, and I don't want to hurt her with this, but this is, you know, that's what happened. She didn't come home. Eventually, after many, many, many hours, I don't even think I had credit on my phone. I had to use the neighbor's phone, and my little sister got rescued by her dad, and nobody came and rescued me. That's when I had to find out where a social worker's office was on my own. And I went down to the social workers. But in that moment of going down there and going back to my house, the locks were changed by the landlord, and everything we owned and had built back up had been gone. I never got anything back again. So we have even special letters from my dad, my clothes, my school stuff. I had flip-flops on, and I remember an orange gypsy skirt that was out back then, and I lived in them clothes for a while. And eventually the social workers helped me out. And then in between that as well.
Where had your mum gone?
I don't know. She was drinking.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and then she'd go and get help, and we'd come back together, and then we'd go homeless, and we were in a homeless shelter.
So it was a vicious circle.
It was a crazy vicious circle. Even in the homeless shelter, it was, you know, made the refuge look like a 5-star holiday home. You know, we were sharing an area with drunken men who they wouldn't put anywhere else. It was a vile, vile, disgusting place. You didn't want to sleep on the beds in there. It was nasty. And my mom went again and didn't come home. And I was in another foster care then.
So when you say that you had at this point, because I know, you know, you do have an incredibly powerful bond with your mother today, goes that saying, but you're speaking about this time in this phase in your life. When you say that you had lost respect for her, how did you feel about yourself at this time?
I didn't really feel there was anything of myself. Like, I didn't even have one person. I don't even know how I did what I did. I don't even know how I stayed in a homeless shelter and knew my mom wasn't coming back. Like, I don't know how. I don't know how I did them. I don't know how I did them things. But I did. And I don't hold a grudge because, having been put in the same circumstances, I have to say, I don't know how I'd handle this situation. But I saw a lot of disgusting things. And I think it really was only for the boyfriend I had at the time, which I misunderstood the possessiveness for caring. I'd found a dad and a boyfriend and a brother and all this. And really is the only thing that kept me going on what I had, because the time that she didn't come back that time, you know, I had to lean on him more, and his mother had to let me stay in the house. Like, I can imagine, like, if my son came home with, like, a girl and was in this situation. It's actually a bit crazy, to be honest. Happened so many times.
So the more, I suppose, dysfunctional your relationship was with your mom, the more you were drawn to this relationship with this guy.
Absolutely. I didn't know any different. And if anyone showed me a slight bit of interest, I'm hooked. I'm hooked. Yeah, I have nobody, literally not one person. I mean, I know I have family, and I know my family love me in Dublin, but I don't think anyone was aware. And I wasn't aware that nobody was aware. All I was aware was nobody gave a damn about me, you know. And I don't blame my mum for that, because when you're intoxicated, you're not doing anything deliberately. Yeah. She needed help, and she was trying to get help, and I am in awe of her looking back at the amount of times she went in to get help, but they let her out all the time, saying she wasn't an alcoholic. like they do with many people, you know, like that she didn't have a problem, she needed counselling. I don't know how they get around that area, but you know, it's still the way it is.
So you were in this relationship with this guy, but then you wanted to kind of do your own thing and get a job and be independent.
Yeah. And as well in this relationship, I kind of been pushed out of school. I was getting bullied from who the guys were that I was hanging around with. And my boyfriend at the time was very, very possessive and controlling, and it didn't suit the relationship for me to go to school or actually be around anybody or wear certain clothes, or did I ever own makeup? No, I wasn't allowed. I didn't care though, because he was my one and only. Anything you say, I'm going to do. But if something came over me and I applied for a job and I got it, and my whole, thank the Lord, my whole view on life changed. But with doing that, that didn't work for my boyfriend at the time. He was not able for this. You know, they live in an arrested development around there. You know, there's been a stunted growth. They don't really see outside their own box. But I had seen so many boxes that I'm open to anything, and I had a different view on life. I got my job. I started hanging around with people who were saving for college, who were renting their own rooms, were doing all these different things. I mean, so myself and my boyfriend broke up. There were times he came up to my job aggressively, and the staff would have to get involved. So we finished, and I was going about my own life, got myself like a moped, and you know, I actually had an argument with my mom, and instead of going to a foster care this time, I pretended to a woman I was 18, and I rented my own room and a house, and I enjoyed playing like grown up girl for a little while, as making my own little bolognese's after work, and it was kind of a cute little time before my mom ended up taking me back home. She didn't realize I'd actually leave and I'd go and do it, but I actually surprised myself at how independent I could be. But when I went back home to my mom, eventually, you know, with my partner, would sit outside my job or outside my house for when I'd finish. It got to the stage where, okay, we'll get back together. And I kind of, you know, well, what was going on my mom at home, and I didn't want anyone else to know. He was nearly a comfort zone. You know, I didn't have to explain anything or get into anything. He knew the shit show I was in. His life wasn't the greatest either, so we were two shit shows together. And I was apprehensive about being with him, and I mentioned wanting a baby. I actually didn't want the baby when I said it. I was kind of trying to scare him away, because that's going to scare any guy away. But he pondered and he thought about it, and he said he was kind of into it. And I remember this was like in a November 2006. And
you were what age, 16?
16, yeah. So wow, a lot happened. I was 16, got a job and did all that. And,
yeah.
And then we didn't try and get pregnant. We just weren't protecting ourselves. And the idea was growing more and more. And for the idea of myself and himself loved each other so much, and we were going to have a baby, and you know, this is our own family we're going to have now. I was going to have what I always wanted, this security, and I was going to be a great mom, la di da.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
So when you found out you were pregnant, how did you feel?
Oh my God, like I was shocked, but like we were all crying, but then happy within minutes. Like it was like everything that both sides of the families needed. It was like a little ray of sunshine, of something to focus on for all of us. I mean, within moments, all I remember is going shopping. I love shopping, so it was an excuse to go and pick out some buggies, clothes. We were well excited. We're on our way to having our own little family now. So that was the the new world again. I was after going into the rainbow came again. And, you know, me and my partner decided then we were going to get our own place. We had all the plans in place of what we were going to do. This meant I didn't have to be taken away again and all these different things. But actual matter of fact, my mom and myself had another altercation, which was enough was enough. And that's where I ended up in a B&B while I was pregnant. And that's how it came to be, how the social workers were involved with the case. So my mom and myself had an altercation. An ambulance had to be called because I knew I was pregnant. I was afraid that I did something, like something could happen to the baby, which it didn't. And the social workers got wind of it and I was put into a B&B this time instead of a foster home. But I had a lot more freedom, and because I was already pregnant, even though I was only 16, my partner was allowed to stay with me in the B&B, which was miles away from the town. I was very excluded from everything. I find that ironic though, that I was put into a B&B with, you know, it was an open B&B for like builders that'd be coming in and out, and the woman who ran it was a glorified alcoholic as well. So that made me feel very uncomfortable. Instead of sitting in a shitty bar, she was drinking fine gins and it just wasn't nice. So I spent a lot more time sleeping on my partner's couch in his family's home.
And on your 17th birthday, you went for your first scan.
Yeah, so I'll never forget that moment, is that morning. So I was in my partner's house, and his house would be busy in the mornings. The mother would be up early and the neighbours would be in drinking coffee and having the gossip, and everybody was all excited to find out what the sex of the baby was. It was my 17th birthday. It was going to be the best day ever, you know. And everybody waved us off, and my mom was on her way up. Everybody was going to be there. And then we went in for our scan in the hospital. And it was only a young nurse. I felt like she wasn't even much older than me at the time. And I remember doing a scan and everything was fine. And we were chatting away about, you know, the do's and don'ts and explaining the pregnancy. And then she just had this really confused look on her face. They didn't find it a problem though, just thought she didn't know what she was doing. And she got more and more confused look, and she went to get a doctor. And then the doctor came back in, a very nice man, I remember. And he started explaining to me my daughter had no skull. I mean, at 17, I don't even think if I was 40 would I be able to comprehend what I was about to be told back then, and I didn't. He told me that she had anencephaly, she would never survive, and you
that,
know,
that basically is a condition where the brain doesn't grow.
It doesn't form, and she actually was severe. She had a severe form of it too. At this stage, I just, the usual me, panicked, ran. We actually ran out of hospital, jumped in a taxi, went home. My mom and his mom was there waiting. They thought we were exaggerating. They were like, no, relax, calm down until we go to the hospital and we find out what it is. I had the word anencephaly on a sticky note and straight away onto Google I went, and life literally went to its craziest point from that day forward. Everything just went upside down.
Because before then, you're planning your future with your little baby.
I was so excited to be pregnant. Yeah. I was so excited to be pregnant. And I did everything possible in the world in that time. I did everything possible to figure out how I can fix this situation. You know, like when you find out a child has an issue, you try and find the cure. And even though I was only young, but I had Google, so I Googled everything, and every single thing I Googled had a dead end. There was no chance of survival. The pictures were disturbing.
Yeah.
There was people who chose to go to term. I looked at them. I tortured myself looking at everything. The longest possibility you would have got was a few hours with the child. I remember at that moment standing, looking at my belly and being infuriated with everybody around me. They were all getting on with their day after they found out about what happened. I'm not saying the parents were, but the brothers and sisters and the friends who had come to celebrate my birthday, everyone was just doing their own thing. But I was like, this alien is in my belly. I need to get this out. That's what I felt like at the time. Okay. I was like, you know, even with my partner, I know he was so upset, but no one could have been as upset and stuck to the situation as I was. I just wanted to rip my stomach out. And I really, really did try my best to try and figure out a way around the anencephaly. No one had ever heard of it before. It was such a rare condition, and there really, really was nothing I could do. So When I figured that out, I knew I had to have an abortion. I knew she needed to come out. I just knew I wanted the problem gone. I had always wanted my baby, so that devastated me. I wasn't into abortion, but to be fair, I didn't really know about abortion. We never were brought up talking about abortion. I definitely never had conversation before that time about it, nor was it said in any school setting or anything. So I had to go and then research and teach myself about all the different procedures you can have. But I knew at that moment I needed her to get out of my stomach. So I had to figure it out. So which I went to what was meant to be, I guess, my parents, you know, the social workers there who were looking after me. And I only went in and spoke to the head social worker thinking like, I never would have thought that I wasn't going to get the help and support I needed. The whole thing got twisted and dirty straight away. I was in fact told in that moment there was no compassion for what I was after telling him. He had told me I'd be done for murder if I did do this. He told me that I'd be arrested and anyone who went with me would be an accomplice to murder. He told me my passport had been stopped. He told me he'd notified the Garda station. I was so flabbergasted at how are these parents not doing what's beneficial for my health right now. And I was already in a bad place in life. Things were not okay. This was the only thing I had. And then I didn't have them either. I didn't feel then I had anybody that I could talk to. It was only for my mom. Somebody whispered in her ear, you should get a solicitor. Like, why would you get a solicitor? You know, I don't know. But just I rang a solicitor. I talked to a solicitor for a few minutes. That's my memory. So maybe it was different.
Yeah.
My memory is I talked to a solicitor on the phone and boom, that's it. We're in a high court.
Yeah.
Whatever happened in between, I was too young to comprehend.
And it happened really quickly.
Oh, very quickly, very quickly. Like, and as well, I would love to thank the solicitor that took me so seriously back then and understood the situation more than I understood the situation as well, to understand that is not okay, that is not right. He must have done his research and actually checked into what the condition was of the child, because he moved quick and we were in the High Court in a blink of an eye.
So you're trying to process this heartbreaking news that your baby is not going to live, and you are feeling all these different emotions because you're trying to process it. Then you go to the people that you feel can help and that you like to think you can trust, and they're not there for you at all. And then you're in the madness of a high court situation. I just can't really get my head around it at 17, trying to process all of that. Is it a blur? Is that time a blur?
Some of the court situations are a blur because I couldn't even understand what was going on in the courtroom. You know, like at first when you go in, I don't remember there being protesters around. I'm learning now that, you know, you need to go to court to apply to be in court, to break it down, to be very dumb and silly about it. And so there was a lot of boring things in between and going back and forth. But then I just remember all of a sudden, which isn't a blur, it's very clear, vivid memories I have of the pro-lifers outside the courts. Now there was pro-choice too. But to be honest, back then it didn't matter if you're pro-choice or pro-life, you were just a gang of people shouting it about my business. And I remember standing in the courtrooms and all these men standing in the room talking. The courts were filled. I there was the normal public were in the rooms. I had people, pro-life people and Christians come over and pray over me and call me a murderer. Only for I had my solicitors at the time. I mean, a lot of disgusting things happened back then. It even turned out one of my mom's closest friends was there every day. He was a Christian and she was there hoping we'd lose. Literally lost faith in everybody.
Whoa.
And I know that, I feel that, you know, the social worker as well, personally, I feel like if I'd have gone to a different social worker, maybe things would have been different, because I don't believe it was just about the legality of the situation. There was definitely a religious view straight away, because he didn't take the time to have compassion and understand my situation. He jumped straight away to make sure that this never happened. And then during the court case, I'm being sent to different psychiatric hospitals and they manipulated the whole situation. They put me in a taxi and say I was going to one place and make them detour and go to another. I mean, things I had to see as a young child in mental homes, you know. the white walls, long corridors. There is really people sitting there doped off their faces, sitting on chairs three times my age. I remember being asked by psychiatrists to do multiplication questions. And I remember the social worker sitting in with me as well, which shouldn't have been allowed. Now I know, back then. And I remember the psychiatric doctor saying that I was actually of a very sound mind. And I actually learned about how kind of emotionally mature I was back then. But the social worker whispered in my ear that I should stay there anyways and take medication and relax. And that's actually when, thank God, my boyfriend was there. And thank God he was possessive, because he wasn't leaving me in. He wasn't leaving me anywhere without him. So thank God. And he made calls to, you know, our moms and stuff like that, and the solicitors, and they made sure they sorted the situation out before I was being convinced to voluntarily sign myself in. Now, I did not know what would happen if I did that, but all they wanted to do was prove that I was suicidal. And damn right, I was going to say I wasn't, because I wasn't. And I believed whatever was going to happen was meant to be. And I believed I deserved to have what I was asking for, because I wasn't trying to be a murderer. I genuinely had wanted this baby. I just wanted help. I needed help.
And the reason they were saying this was the only reason an abortion would have been granted back in 2007 was if the woman was suicidal.
Yeah, now that wasn't made very clear to me either. I heard that's why they were doing it. But I never was going to turn around and say I was suicidal when I wasn't.
When you weren't, yeah.
When I wasn't, like, I wasn't. That's a very, very, very big statement to make. And I knew back then, from what I was after going through and what I'd seen as a child, if I made myself out to be suicidal, there was going to be repercussions for that afterwards. And I didn't want to get signed in somewhere when I actually felt very clear and strong-minded in what was going on.
Yeah.
Things just got really bad, and it was very frustrating, especially looking back as a grown woman, looking at all these strange men in the courtroom deciding the fate of my life with my body. It's infuriating, and I still don't get it.
Yeah. Can you talk about the day the judge spoke and gave his verdict?
I didn't go that day. I'd actually had enough of court at that day. And I remember getting the phone call from my mom saying, "You won," and the solicitor. And by God, did I not win? You know, during the court case, I was making different decisions, and I was keeping on researching and torturing my brain. And I didn't know if I wanted an abortion anymore. And, you know, for everyone, you won. And I was like, this is only the start. Now that the hustle and bustle is over of the courtrooms, the real tragic personal situation begins of what the hell am I going to do now that I have a choice? Now that I have a choice, I need to make the right choice. And it brought the reality back. And, you know, during that time, my tummy was after growing. I wasn't just carrying what I had said at the start, an alien. I had felt the flutters of her going to the court. I connected with her. She wasn't just like a situation anymore. She was my baby. She was Jasmine. I really loved her and wanted her. I knew she was a girl. Like, I was so attached to her at this stage, and it was very heartbreaking then to have to go and meet up with people and sit like I'm looking at a menu and planning which procedure I want out of the booklet, you know. So a lot of heartache came after winning, they say, in the court case. I don't feel like I won at all. And if things that had been done correctly, I believe, in the situation that I had, I should have been supported and looked over in Ireland instead of having to organise bringing a coffin back like luggage from a different country. I didn't win at all.
Yeah. So you went to Liverpool for the, as you said, the procedure and having to decide what to do.
Yeah, because the gestation I was at is all my pregnancy.
You were 19 weeks at the stage.
Yeah, so other options became available to me. You know, they're not allowed to help you pick, but they can point at something for you in these family planning clinics. And I became aware of an induced labour. And that was it for me. I was so happy. I felt like I could give baby Jasmine the respect she deserved. I can push her out. I'd learned about how abortions happen, and I did not feel comfortable one bit whatsoever. So I decided to have to induce labour, and that gave me so much peace of mind. I obviously didn't plan the flights. I was only a child. I didn't plan the procedure. I just said what I wanted, and it was organised for me, which is the most infuriating part, I feel like, of my whole life, really, of how that panned out. Whoever planned this situation for me going to hospital in Liverpool didn't plan it properly. They never put thought or empathy into what's going to happen, what it entails to deliver a baby, an induced baby. You know, you don't go over there and you pop a baby out and then come home. You know, I was in an I had to go into an induced labor. I spent days over there, and by the time I had her, it was time to go.
Yeah, you had to leave straight away.
Mm-hmm. When I get over there, I went and settled in the hotel, and it was another strange time, I'll get into it, where the two mothers came and my partner, and I was on medication. I was starting to feel very sick. There were 3 or 4 days before I was taken into hospital to be induced. And when I was in to be induced, the labor did last 16 hours. It was torturous and painful. At this stage, I wasn't aware that Jasmine had already stopped breathing. So I was adamant that I would not take any medication. And I was suffering a lot of pain because in my innocence, I believed that she might take a breath. Even though I knew going to full term, she wasn't even going to survive. I just felt like she'd take a breath. I'd get to see my baby. I'd get a birth cert, all the rest. I remember looking at my mom hours into labor and her promising me and telling me to trust her, holding my hand, telling me to take the morphine and that I needed it and I'd be okay. And it was in the middle of the night then that I remember giving birth to Jasmine and pushing her out. And even after that, I didn't understand what an afterbirth was. I mean, that's how young I was. And the afterbirth was actually bigger and harder to get out than Jasmine. And in that blur of a moment, I remember after that, I just remember blood and the baby being taken away and I passed out. So this is in the middle of the night, like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I pass out. And then like my boyfriend wakes me up and puts me in a wheelchair, and I have a room next door with the baby in it. And it took a few times to go in. It was very emotional. And oh my God, when I seen her, she was like perfect. She was a baby. She had toes, she had fingers, she had nails, she had little legs, she had little knees. She was in a little dress, and her nappy was the smallest nappy you could probably ever buy and nearly took over her. Her band that is usually around a baby's wrist was around her tummy. Even though she was so small, she was so perfect. She had every feature except for the fact that her face was covered. And that's what I'm really angry about. I'm not angry her face is covered. I'm angry that I wasn't given enough time to process the situation, to see my baby, and that I still haven't seen my baby, and I'll never be able to not be okay with that. I can get through everything else, but like I still wish I see my baby's face. I was taught I could look at her face if I wanted to, and I know some of them did, but I still wasn't even sober, and they were like doing things and planning a priest coming in, and I had to keep leaving the room and going back in, and I would hold her whole hand rested on the top of my baby nail. Like, I'm just really angry.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even of recent of late, I'm wondering, does anyone have a photo of my child's face? Because I just can't. I don't think that's something that I'll never rest with, because who books a flight for a woman to come home at 10 o'clock in the morning after giving birth? I didn't have a procedure. I didn't go and get my boobs done or something. I went and had a baby. Who plans things to be that way? I begged and I begged to stay. And I remember being so jealous of looking at the priest holding my child for a blessing. And I never got to hold her. I only got to touch her. I was not given enough time to get the courage to pick her up. She was so small and so dainty. It enraged me looking at the priest holding her. And then all of a sudden, you know, I get handed fingerprints and handprints and yeah, a beautiful box. The nurses were absolutely amazing. But like signing over documents to leave my child behind was probably one of the most heartbreaking things that I've ever had to do in my life. And I hope it's the only thing heartbreaking I've ever got to do now for the rest of my life. I screamed, I held on to the walls. You're leaving your baby, not just in a hospital on their own, but in a country on their own. And I'm thinking of things like, what if a passerby goes into the wrong room and sees my child? What if somebody goes in just to look at my child? how long is she going to be left there for? So many questions I didn't get answers from, you know. I couldn't even walk. I was just taken straight out of place in a wheelchair. You know, to leave her behind in a different country is absolutely disgusting. And then to have to organise her being brought home like luggage on a plane and sign papers if I wanted her to be cut open to be tested. Basically, that's what I saw it as a child. And I was like, how can you even put a butter knife to my child? Like, it's such mad, crazy decisions that I had to do at that age. Yeah, and then just put on a plane and back home, and everyone got on with their lives.
And when you came back, to Ireland, Jasmine was buried.
It took a few weeks for Jasmine to get brought back to Ireland, and that was another time of life that wasn't easy. The minute I got home, there was newspapers torturing me and all the rest. But in between that, I was trying to organise a funeral for a baby. So I didn't understand that your baby didn't take a breath, so she didn't in fact matter to be a real person. So I never got to go to the church. And looking, like, I know as an adult now that I actually was given such a respectful service, but back then I didn't feel that was the way, you know. I was only young. I had to organise the size of coffin she was going to be put in. I had to organise where she was going to go in a second coffin, because the crucifix wouldn't fit in the first coffin. I had the envisions of her being on a flight and people who worked in the airport holding her coffin, shaking it, being tugged around in the plane. And, you know, and then even when she got home, I was wondering, you know, if I go up to the funeral home, will they let me see her face then? There was always this, I didn't get to see her effing face, like, you're my own child. But they did, like, my mother did, and to this day, and his mother, and I think my partner at the time did as well. The conversations that can't be had. There's so many things that can trigger it off. And knowing that they got to see her face, and I have to listen to how they describe her and take it from that, or look at Adam and try and fix it. I know she was gorgeous. I know if she was the way she was meant to be, she was going to be gorgeous, and she's gorgeous to me.
Yeah.
But I don't feel rested having not gotten the chance to see her. And I did when she was buried after the funeral we had to go through, which was an unusual experience too. Like, I actually would sit at the side of the grave, and I'm not joking, I wanted to dig her up. I would have to counsel myself to tell myself that even if I did, she was going to be so much more deteriorated than what she was. And I did. I sat there many times at midnight when I had fights with my partner. That's where I went. Every time there was anything, I went to the graveyard in the middle of the night. It didn't matter, in the rain. And I would think about digging up her coffin. And there was even random moments years later where I'm like, will I? Only to then have to think in my head, she's bones, you know, like. But they were real moments. They're real crazy, irrational moments that I just really wanted. I felt then as well, like, digging her up, yeah, I know I could get in trouble, but at the same time I'd be like, hold on, it's my child, it's my child's grave. I there was times where I was like, should I not have the coffin in my house? Like, she's my baby. Like, there's crazy things that happen to you when you go through some crazy things.
Yeah, no one can understand what you've been through unless they have experienced it themselves. So I'm not going to patronise you by saying that I get how you feel, because I have no idea how that feels.
If anybody did say they understood me, I would probably be annoyed, to be honest.
Yeah,
it would agitate me, even trying to get counselling. The amount of times I've had to sit with a counsellor and explain what ankephaly means, to the extent that by the time you nearly finish explaining the legalities of things as well, they don't even understand. Like, they are not even trained to the extent of what I have needed. I was promised aftercare. I was never given it. Anyone who I've sent to was not qualified enough to deal with the traumas that I had to go through to even understand. I feel like I was nearly teaching them a thing or two when I was sitting there. I have had to self-counsel myself ever since this has happened. And, you know, for every trauma that happens, I believe you get stronger and stronger. And thank God I've been able to see things in a different way. And having Adam has, I even thought about this recently. If I hadn't had Adam when I did, I believe I would definitely be in fear of getting pregnant, for thinking that I could not carry a healthy child. I am so grateful and thankful that he came straight away afterwards, which was not planned, but I wasn't being careful once again.
So within a short period of time,
I had basically Irish twins. if once they both were here. Yeah, yeah, they were both. They both within a year. Yeah. Like I gave birth to two children within a year.
Yeah.
But the whole the pregnancy was, I didn't tell people till I was about 5 months pregnant because of the previous one. And I was well looked after in hospital, but even in the birth of Adam was absolutely traumatic because it took me right back to Jasmine. And that's it again. Thank God I dealt with, that's like more counselling than you can be given, because I would have feared the pregnancy and the birth, but I had to deal with it and get on with it. You just have to, you have to give birth, the baby has to come out. So thank God that happened so quickly afterwards. And although I didn't want to push Adam out when I was halfway through the labour, he came out, and he came out a healthy, chubby little baby boy that yeah. changed my whole life forever.
Yeah, and he's a teenager now.
Oh, he is indeed. He is a teenager. That reminds me of being a teenager, and he can't pull the wool over my eyes. It's a very interesting time of life right now, because I know how important it is to go the left or right way in life, you know, and he's yeah. living in the same area that I was living in when I went the wrong way. So it's like I'm drilled into him, you know. Anytime I see an inkling of bad behavior, I'm on his case, like. But he's been my best friend. Like, we've gone on our holidays and our own together. We did everything together. Now he won't go anywhere with me because he's a teenager. Yeah, you know, I'm an embarrassment. Yeah. But he's literally been the light and shine in my life. I mean, 4 weeks after he was born, I went back to school.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, like
you did your leaving.
Yeah, I did my leaving for him, for a better life for him. I don't know if I would have done that had it been just for me. Yeah. A year after he was born, I left my partner. I decided that he was not going to see.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Toxic arguments that were happening in the house anymore, you know. I'm very proud of myself for doing that at 18, deciding I was going to live a life on my own with a child. I did it. I went straight back into college. I finished college as well. I did 2 years in college. I worked 2 and 3 jobs at a time just to have the lifestyle for me and Adam that I remember I did have as a child.
And now your relationship with your mother is actually very good.
As well, because we did talk so sad about my mom. That was a 4 year stint of a terrible time. From the moment I kept it very quiet, what was going on in my relationship with Adam's father, it was really bad. And she became aware of it. I believe from the moment she seen her daughter was in a very bad situation, that was it. I just remember she didn't drink anymore. she, you know, like it took a bit of time, but she was there straight away. If I didn't have her, I wouldn't have been able to do the courses, do the college, do the jobs, do all the fun things I've gotten to do since. She's literally been stuck to my hip. I think, God bless her, she's been trying to forever make up for the hard time we went through, and she's overdoing it at this stage, which doesn't need to stop. But she no mother could be there more than what she is for me now. She's like my shadow.
I'm so delighted to hear that you have that back again, despite everything you've gone through. The book is really, really powerful, and I wish you the very best with it. It's called I Am Amy Dunn, and it's written with the help of Orla O'Donnell, the legal affairs correspondent for RT. It is out now, and I just wish you all the very best for the future. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Amy's strength and integrity throughout her court case helped to empower so many others who found themselves in a similar situation afterwards. I think she's amazing, and I wish her all the love and luck in the world. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real Conversations.